Israelites to whom pertain the adoption? How could Paul make it any plainer than this, which is in Romans 11, verses 1 and 2? I say then, has God cast away his people? God forbid. For I also am an Israelite, of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not cast away his people, which he foreknew. Remember what he says about those whom God foreknew? For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called. And whom he called, them he also justified. And whom he justified, them he also glorified. Since God's people Israel are those whom he foreknew, then this is written about them. Now let's look at the writings of other apostles in the New Testament. What about James? James addresses his epistle to the 12 tribes scattered abroad. This couldn't be to the Jews, because first of all, they were not of any of the tribe of Israel. Neither were they scattered abroad when James wrote, nor for 10 years thereafter. They were still collected together in Palestine. It couldn't even be the people of the kingdom of Judah, for they were never more than the 3 tribes of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. And James is speaking to the 12 tribes scattered abroad. Now we know from history that the Assyrians took into captivity, first, all the people of the 10 northern tribes who made up the kingdom of Israel. Then the Assyrians, under King Sennacherib, invaded the southern kingdom of Judah and deported over 200,000 of its people in the same captivity with the 10 tribes. And finally, we know from historical sources that upon the fall of Babylon, the tribes of Israel, who were by that time known as Scythians, swooped down on Babylon and carried off most of the people of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi, who were captives at Babylon, leaving behind them just the relatively few who returned to Palestine with Ezra and Nehemiah. So when James wrote his epistle in the year 60 A.D., the 12 tribes were scattered abroad, and by that time were known as the Angli, the Saxonis, the Ostrogoths, the Visigoths, and the Royal Scyths, and were already moving on their long march into their predestined homes in Europe. It was to them that James was writing. Well, what about Peter? The first epistle of Peter leaves no doubt that he was writing to Israelites. The first verse is badly mistranslated in your King James Version. Instead of the strangers scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, as your King James Version reads, the actual wording in the Greek is this: to the exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Now Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia are the eastern part of modern Turkey, and we know that the Scythian tribes of Israel did occupy this region before they moved out on their long journey into Europe. They were exiles from their original homeland in Palestine, and they were dispersed over a wide region. Finally, to clinch the matter, Peter identifies them in the second verse as elect, according to the foreknowledge of God the Father. But who were God's elect? In Isaiah 45, verse 4, God speaks of Israel, mine elect. And as to the foreknowledge of God, remember that in Romans 11, verse 2, Paul confirms that God has not cast away his people which he foreknew. Elect is only another word for chosen. And in Deuteronomy 7, verse 6, the people of Israel are told that the Lord thy God has chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all the people that are upon the face of the earth. But let's look further into what Peter has to say. In 1 Peter 2, verse 9, he says to these exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, and so forth, "But ye are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praise of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. I know that your King James Version Bible says, a chosen generation, but that's mistranslation, for the word in the Greek is genos, meaning a race, not a generation. This couldn't describe anyone but Israel. The chosen race is Israel. Among many other places, we find it in Isaiah 44, verse 1. Yet now hear, O Jacob my servant, and Israel whom I have chosen. And Deuteronomy 7, verse 6. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all the people that are upon the face of the earth. Next, he spoke of a royal priesthood, a holy nation. This also can only be Israel, for Exodus 19, verse 6 tells the people of Israel that, ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. A peculiar people is another identifying mark of Israel, for Deuteronomy 14, verse 2 says, For thou art a holy people unto the Lord thy God, and the Lord hath chosen thee to be a peculiar people unto himself above all the nations that are upon the earth. And finally, that ye should show forth the praise of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light is another identifying mark of Israel. For in Isaiah 43, verse 21, God says, This people have I formed for myself. They shall show forth my praise. I've skipped over the epistle to the Hebrews, which is not signed, but is usually credited to Paul. I can't imagine anyone disputing that this book, as indicated in its title, is written to, as well as written about, the Hebrews, the Israelites. Probably we needn't say any more about it here, and if I were to start in on that book, it alone would take several hours to cover. I'll go into that some other time. Now, what about the book of Revelation? Is this also an Israel book? No book in the whole Bible is as little understood as the book of Revelation. It's a prophetic book, history pre-written. But it's much more difficult to understand than any other prophetic book because it is written almost completely in symbols. It is probably safe to say that no man has ever correctly and completely understood this book. But this doesn't diminish its value to us. It was not meant to make its prophecies so clear that we could use them in advance as a guide to gambling on the stock market, for example. It was chiefly intended that, after the prophesied event had happened, those who had studied the symbolism could recognize the actual event as having been prophesied, and thus both to prove the true inspiration of the book and also to show us how far we had come through the predestined course of history. I don't claim the total and infallible knowledge, which indeed all men lack, and I shall not try to completely explain this book to you, but I shall try to make clear much of its symbolism. The period of time covered by the book of Revelation is the entire Christian era, and even beyond into the beginnings of eternity. When the prophet Daniel wrote his prophecies, those were not for his own times, but for what was then the remote future. So the angel told Daniel, But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. But in contrast to this, the angel told John in Revelation 22, verse 10, Seal not the sayings of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. So the book of Revelation prophetically covers all time from John's own day onward. No one can hope to understand any of this book unless he knows that it's an Israel book and most of its symbols are Israel symbols. When we recognize this, many of the difficult passages become fairly clear. Let's examine some of them. In the fourth chapter, John is given a vision of the throne of God, and in verses 6 and 7 he describes its surroundings. And in the midst of the throne and round about the throne were four living creatures, And the first living creature was like a lion, and the second living creature like a young bullock, and the third living creature had a face like a man, and the fourth living creature was like a flying eagle. In the first chapter of Ezekiel, that prophet also beheld the throne of God, and likewise saw that it was surrounded by four living creatures whose faces were, respectively, those of a man, a lion, a bull, and an eagle. What's the meaning of those four living creatures on the four sides of the throne? This was the camp of Israel, formed in a hollow square with the tabernacle of God in the center, as it's described in the second chapter of the book of Numbers. The tribes were commanded to form their encampments in a hollow square, protectively surrounding the tabernacle in the center. On the east side of the square camped the three tribes of Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, under the leadership of Judah, whose banner was a lion. On the south side were camped the tribes of Reuben, Simeon, and Gad, led by Reuben, whose banner was a man. On the west side camped the tribes of Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin, led by Ephraim, whose banner was a bull. And on the north camped Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, led by Dan, whose banner was a flying eagle. This shouldn't surprise you, for the symbolism is both clear and logical. Where should the throne of God be found but in the midst of the camp of his people Israel? Around God's throne, John saw 24 lesser thrones on which sat 24 elders wearing crowns. In the fifth chapter, these elders sing, "Thou hast made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth." This again identifies them as Israel, for we read in the 19th chapter of Exodus that God said, "Ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation," which is something never said about anyone but Israel. There were 24 of these elders, two for each tribe. We are not told directly how these 24 are selected, but a logical explanation would seem to be that 12 of them are the original patriarchs, the 12 sons of Israel. As to the other 12, Jesus Christ told the apostles, "Verily I say unto you, that ye which have followed me, in the regeneration when the Son of Man shall sit on the throne of his glory, ye also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." In the 7th chapter of Revelation, John saw four angels holding back the four winds, so that the great storms of war and conflict could not overwhelm the earth until the seal of God's protection was placed upon his servants. John heard the angel command, "Hurt not the earth, neither the sea nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads." God's servants, of course, are his people Israel. In Isaiah 44, verses 21 to 23, God says, "Remember these, O Jacob and Israel, for thou art my servant. I have formed thee, thou art my servant. O Israel, thou shalt not be forgotten of me. I have blotted out as a thick cloud thy transgressions, and as a cloud thy sins. Return unto me, for I have redeemed thee. Sing, O ye heavens, for the Lord hath done it. Shout, ye lower parts of the earth. Break forth into singing, ye mountains, O forest, and every tree therein. For the Lord has redeemed Jacob, and glorified himself in Israel." Therefore, when John witnesses the sealing of God's servants, he tells us, "And I heard the number of them which were sealed, and there were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel." Then the 7th chapter goes on to list the different tribes which were so sealed. All the tribes except Dan are mentioned, and Dan was omitted for a good reason. The world of which this book is speaking when it describes the various plagues which are to come upon the world as the consequences of the people's wickedness is the Roman world, the portion of the earth then occupied by the various beast nations of the Babylonian succession of world empires. By the time John wrote the book of Revelation, the tribe of Dan had already migrated out of this area, partly by sea through the Straits of Gibraltar into the British Isles and beyond, partly across Europe through the Danube Valley to the Baltic Sea and on to the peninsula of Denmark. Therefore, the tribe of Dan did not need special protection from the plagues, which were about to fall upon the whole Roman world empire. Next, in the 11th chapter, we find that John was given a reed like a measuring rod and was told, "Rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. But the court which is without the temple, leave out and measure it not, for it is given to the Gentiles." Now, the prophet Ezekiel was similarly told to observe the measurement of the temple of God in Ezekiel chapters 40 through 43. This, of course, was exclusively an Israel institution, for no other race or nation has ever had it. It was always true that the temple was exclusively for Israelites, and others were forbidden to enter the temple proper. Thus we find God saying in Ezekiel 44, verses 6 to 9, "O ye house of Israel, let it suffice you of all your abominations, in that ye have brought into my sanctuary strangers, uncircumcised in heart and uncircumcised in flesh, to be in my sanctuary, to pollute it, even my house, and ye have not kept the charge of mine holy things. Thus says the Lord God, no stranger, uncircumcised in heart nor uncircumcised in flesh, shall enter into my sanctuary of any stranger that is among the children of Israel." Consistent with this rule, John was told in Revelation 11, verse 2, "But the court which is without the temple, leave out and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles." Thus we see that even in the prophetic future, the separation of God's people Israel from all other nations and races is kept clear. And it should be. If God was right in the first place, his will should remain consistent. And what kind of a God would it be who could be wrong and would have to change after someone showed him his mistakes? No, our God was right in the beginning and through all eternity. Therefore, his book, the Bible, is an Israel book from Genesis through Revelation. The 12th chapter of Revelation begins thus, "And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars." This reference to the sun, moon, and 12 stars is old Israel symbolism, first used in Genesis 37, verses 9 to 11, where the boy Joseph tells his brothers and his father Israel of his dream. "And he dreamed yet another dream, and he told it to his brethren, and said, Behold, I dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth? And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying." Israel himself correctly interpreted the dream. The sun was himself, the moon was his wife, and the 11 stars were Joseph's brother. Joseph himself made the 12th. So we see in Revelation 12, verse 1, that the symbolic woman, clothed with the sun, having the moon under her feet, and wearing a crown of 12 stars, symbolizes the race of Israel. Then the following verses make this unmistakably clear, where it says, "And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth, and pained to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his heads. And the tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. Now, obviously, the man-child destined to rule all nations with a rod of iron is Jesus Christ. For Revelation 19, verses 11 to 16 clearly says so. And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. And he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. And he has on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Again, we know the Israel symbolism to be correct, for it was God's people Israel which gave birth to Jesus Christ. In Romans 9, verses 4 and 5, it speaks of Israelites, to whom pertain the adoption and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the service of God and the promises, whose are the fathers, and of whom, as concerning the flesh, Christ came. So we see correctly symbolized God's people Israel giving birth to Jesus Christ, while the red dragon stood waiting to devour him as soon as he was born. We know that the Edomite Jew, King Herod, did try to murder Jesus Christ within a few days after his birth. Likewise, Revelation 12, verse 5 tells us that the woman's child was caught up unto God and to his throne. We know that Jesus Christ, after his resurrection, did ascend to heaven, for he sits on the throne of God. Revelation 12, verses 6, 13 to 17, further confirm the Israel identity. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared of God. We know that the peoples of Israel spent centuries migrating through the wilderness to their new homes in northern and western Europe, far beyond the reach of the evil powers of the Babylonian succession of empires, the beast nations. These verses further say, And when the dragon saw that he was cast into the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. Yes, this Jewish dragon did from the very beginning. Read these verses of the book of Acts, and you will see that it was always the Jews who caused the persecution of the early Christians. Chapter 4, verses 1 to 3 and 16 to 21. Chapter 5, verses 17 and 18. Also verses 27 to 33. Chapter 6, verse 8 to chapter 7, verse 60. Chapter 9, verses 22 and 23. Chapter 12, verses 1 to 4 and 11. Chapter 13, verses 44 and 45 and verse 50. Chapter 14, verses 2 and 19. Chapter 17, verses 5 and 13. Chapter 18, verse 12. Chapter 20, verses 1 to 3. Chapter 21, verse 27. And chapter 23, verse 12. But God never abandoned his people, for Revelation 12, verse 14 tells us, And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place. Again, this is familiar Israel symbolism, for in Exodus 19, verse 4, God tells his people, Ye have seen how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. But the serpent's Jewish people, having failed to kill off the people of Israel, tried another weapon against them. For Revelation 12, verses 15 and 16 says, And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. Now Revelation 17 verse 15 tells us, "The waters which thou sawest are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues." So the serpent's new attack was an attempt to destroy God's race by mongrelization, which is the worst of all forms of so-called genocide. The great Asiatic invasions under Attila and Genghis Khan were sent to overrun and intermix with the Israelites on their march into Europe, but instead they succeeded only in hurrying the migration of Israel and were not able to overrun them. Finally, the identification of Israel is completed in chapter 12, verse 17. "And the dragon was wroth with the woman, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God, and have the testimony of Jesus Christ." We know that all the real Israelite nations today do have the testimony of Jesus Christ, not Judaism, but Christianity. Call the roll of the great Christian nations of the world today, those who have demonstrated what true Christianity can do for the nation which will wholeheartedly follow it, and you have the list of the Anglo-Saxon nations: Britain, Canada, Australia, South Africa, the United States, Germany, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and heroic little Finland. These are the outstanding leaders of Christianity today, those who have the testimony of Jesus Christ. There are some pockets of Israel peoples existing as minorities in several other nations of Europe, but those I have named are the nations which are predominantly Israel. Remember that when this was written by John, all but the lifetime of Jesus Christ was still in the future. Prophecy is authenticated by what eventually occurs, and this prophecy has abundantly proven its true inspiration by coming to pass. But it has also proven the Israel identity of the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, and Germanic peoples, for the Israel symbolism shows that the people who were to do these things are the true Israelites. Much of the book of Revelation is devoted to Great Babylon. The original city of Babylon had perished by the time John wrote this book, yet he speaks of Great Babylon in prophecies extending to the end of this age. Therefore, he is speaking of the Babylonian system, which did not end with the fall of the city, but is with us even today. It completely dominates our present economic and financial system. It forms a powerful portion of our present religious system, and it dominates the political systems of the world today. But even Babylon must be subject to the laws of God when the final judgment comes, as we will see. I could spend many hours covering in detail either the economic or the religious systems of Great Babylon as they exist in the world today. But that's beyond the scope of my present purpose, which is to show the Israel symbolism in this book. So we'll content ourselves now with merely noticing the existence of Great Babylon in the world today. Chapter 17 deals with religious Babylon in its present form, while chapter 18 covers the Babylonian economic system of today. From the description given, it's easy to identify those of whom it is speaking. Let's examine it. An angel announces the fall of this system and the despair of those who have used it to gain power over all the world. He tells them, "Thy merchants were the great men of the earth, for by thy sorceries were all the nations deceived." And he describes which merchants these are: those who handle the merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls, and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet, and all aromatic wood, and all manner vessels of ivory, and all manner vessels of most precious wood, and of brass and iron and marble, and cinnamon and odors and ointments and frankincense, and wine, and oil, and fine flour, and wheat, and cattle, and sheep, and horses, and chariots, and slaves, and souls of men." There you have it. Gold and jewelry, the clothing industry, luxury items, the drug industry, the liquor industry, wholesale foods, and the meatpacking industry. When you find the people who have largely monopolized these trades, and you know that those are the Jews, you have thereby identified the economic side of Great Babylon. But the Babylonian system in all its phases is evil and has brought misery and grief to the great majority of the people of the world for these many centuries. Therefore, God prophesies its overthrow and judgment in this chapter. We are warned to drive them out, for God tells us in chapter 18, verses 4 and 5, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." The judgment which we, yes, I mean we, are commanded to execute upon Great Babylon is pure Israel law. God commands us to reward her even as she rewarded you, and double unto her double according to her works. In the cup which she has filled, fill to her double. Under Israel law, a thief must always restore to his victim at least double what he stole. For example, Exodus 22, verse 9 commands, "For all manner of trespass, whether it be for ox, for ass, for sheep, for raiment, or for any manner of lost thing which another challenges to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor." This being justice to require of God's people, surely it is the very minimum justice to require of Satan's children. Again, we are told in this 18th chapter of Revelation that the evil activities of this great Babylon has been basically responsible for all the murders of the innocent. For it says, "And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth." Remember that this book is prophetic of all time, even to the end of this age, so it covers their guilt of the millions of Christians who have been murdered behind the Iron Curtain in our own day, as well as the other millions slain in the wars which Jewish plots have brought on and are bringing on. Can we identify them? Yes, because Jesus Christ himself identified them for us. In Matthew 23, verses 29 to 35, speaking to the Jews, he clearly referred to the same thing, saying, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because ye build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore ye be witnesses unto yourselves that ye are the children of them which killed the prophets. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers, ye serpents, ye offspring of vipers. How can ye escape the damnation of hell? Wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets, and wise men, and scribes, and some of them ye shall kill and crucify, and some of them ye shall scourge in your synagogues, and persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias the son of Barachias, whom ye slew between the temple and the altar." In carrying on to its conclusion the conspiracy originated by their ancestors, the Jews also take upon themselves the responsibility from the beginning to the end. Even they recognize this, for in Matthew 27, verse 25, they acknowledged it. For we read, "Then answered all the peoples and said, His blood be upon us and on our children." So the book of Revelation, opening up the future to the time of the end, shows how this judgment finally comes upon them. Going on to the 20th chapter of Revelation, we again find Israel in the picture, for we read, "And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them." This is the very thing of which Jesus Christ spoke to his disciples in Matthew 19, verse 28, when he told them, "Verily I say unto you, that ye which have followed me, in the regeneration when the Son of Man shall sit on the throne of his glory, ye also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." This is not the judgment of the wicked, for Jesus Christ has already executed judgment upon the Babylonian system and the beast nations in chapter 19. And the last judgment of the wicked, after the end of the 1,000 years of Christ's reign and the second resurrection for judgment, is conducted by God, not by men. So this reference to some sitting upon thrones and being judges refers to the disciples being judges over Israel. Rule by judges is an old Israel institution, as the book of Judges in the Old Testament sets forth in detail. So the book of Revelation shows that this Israel institution is in effect again during the millennium. We shouldn't be surprised at any of this. God was right, even from the beginning. He chose his people Israel forever to be his servants and show the world how glorious his rule can be. While some individuals, by their misconduct, have failed to secure this glory for themselves, yet they cannot frustrate God's will. In Isaiah 43:21, God says, "This people have I formed for myself. They shall show forth my praise." The book of Revelation shows that they do, even into eternity. We started on this 20th chapter, which deals with the millennium, the thousand-year reign of Jesus Christ over all the earth. During this age, Jesus Christ rules the Gentile nations with a rod of iron, compelling them to live by the laws of God. This had been prophesied in the 4th chapter of Micah, where it says, "And he shall judge among many people, and rebuke strong nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. For the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken it." Even men who think of themselves as religious have thought that they can bring this to pass by their own wisdom and power, through alliances with Satan and the United Nations, which bars all mention of the name of Jesus Christ. But no good can ever come from a godless source. Disarmament and peace can come only when the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken it, not when it's spoken by Kennedy and Khrushchev, by Adlai Stevenson and Mao Tse-tung. The Gentile races have lived under their own rule, according to their own ideals, for 6,000 years or more. 6,000 years of continuous tyranny and cruelty, poverty and disease, misery and filth. They have rejected the laws of God, so they must receive the consequences of their own choice. Proverbs 1, verses 29 to 31 tells it. "They hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would none of my counsel. They despised all my reproof. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way and be filled with their own devices." But during the millennium, they'll be compelled, against their will, by a rod of iron, to live in obedience to God's laws, and they will see that peace and prosperity result from it. Yet they won't be convinced, because it's not in their nature to understand it. Jesus Christ explained this to his disciples in the 14th through the 17th chapters of John. And there he said, "And I will pray the Father, and he shall give you another Comforter, that he may abide with you forever, even the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it sees him not, neither knows him. I have manifested thy name unto the men which thou gavest me out of the world. Thine they were, and thou gavest them me. I pray for them. I pray not for the world, but for them which thou hast given me." And this is exactly what Micah prophesied. For in the next verse after those which I quoted to you, telling of the great peace the nations would have under the personal reign of Jesus Christ, Micah goes on to say, "For all people will walk, every one, in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever." So don't expect the other races and nations to be converted, even during the millennium. Therefore, we read in Revelation 20, verses 7 to 9, "And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison, and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth, and compassed the camp of the saints about, and the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven, and devoured them." Against whom do these Afro-Asian nations make war? The saints, it says. And you remember who the saints are. the people of Israel. Finally, the 21st chapter of Revelation describes the Lamb's wife, the New Jerusalem, the city of God's people. Here again, many churches have taught false doctrine because they wouldn't take the trouble to study the Bible, but only their own doctrines. Before it's too late, they should remember that Jesus Christ quoted those terrible words from Isaiah, "In vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." They distort the whole Bible, trying to apply all of God's promises to their own church. Some of them teach that Christ's bride is the church. They never got that out of the Bible, which teaches plainly that the church is Christ's body. As Paul says in Ephesians 1, verses 22 and 23, "And has put all things under his feet, and gave him to be head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him that fills all in all." Now, nobody marries his own body. Christ's wife is his people Israel, as the Bible shows in many places. For example, Jeremiah 3, verses 12 and 14. "Go and proclaim these words toward the north, and say, Return, thou backsliding Israel, saith the Lord, and I will not cause mine anger to fall upon you. For I am merciful, says the Lord, and I will not keep anger forever. Turn, O backsliding children, says the Lord, for I am married unto you." Again, in the 54th chapter of Isaiah, God says to Israel, "Fear not, for thou shalt not be ashamed, neither be thou confounded, for thou shalt not be put to shame. For thou shalt forget the shame of thy youth, and shalt not remember the reproach of thy widowhood any more. For thy Maker is thine husband, the Lord of hosts is his name, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, the God of the whole earth shall he be called." The description of the holy city, the New Jerusalem, given in the 21st chapter of Revelation, again shows that this is God's people Israel. It describes the foundations of its walls, naming the stones of which it is made. These are the same stones which were set in the breastplate of the high priest of Israel. Also, it describes the city as surrounded by a high wall, saying, "And it had a wall great and high, and 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. On the east, 3 gates, on the north, 3 gates, on the south, 3 gates, and on the west, 3 gates." As we have seen, this is the familiar hollow square of the camp of Israel, with 3 tribes on each of the 4 sides. But in this final city of God, set up for all eternity, note that it is surrounded by a high wall, so that nobody can get in except through one of the gates. And these gates are the 12 tribes of Israel. In Revelation 22, verse 14, it says, "Blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life, and may enter in through the gates into the city." So never let anyone tell you that the Jews are Israel, for we have often proved they are not. Never let anyone tell you that God has cast off his people Israel, for he has not. The whole Bible is an Israel book, commencing with its first book, Genesis, and now we have seen that even the last book, that of Revelation, is also an Israel book, not only through all of this age, but even through eternity. We've covered enough to show that the New Testament and the Old Testament are just the two sides of the same coin, which has the same value whichever side you look at. If this were not so, we couldn't have confidence in either one of them, for truth must always be consistent with itself. Jesus Christ came not to take back God's promises and nullify the prophecies, but rather, as Paul said in Romans 15, verse 8, "Now I say that Jesus Christ was a minister of the circumcision for the truth of God, to confirm the promises made unto the fathers." All that had been promised to Abraham and Moses was to be made good. And likewise, these promises to Abraham and Moses included the basis for Christianity. In fact, Moses was a Christian. Does that startle you when you remember that Moses died more than 1,400 years before Christ was born? Yet the New Testament tells us that Moses was a Christian. In Hebrews chapter 11, verses 24 to 26, it says this: By faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasure of Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. Now it is certain that he could not have esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt unless he truly understood what all the rituals he taught the people really meant, that they spoke of the coming Redeemer. So it is that Hebrews 10, verse 1, speaks of the law having a shadow of the good things to come. And the book of Hebrews explains how the rituals were only symbols of the coming of Christ and his sacrifice for us. Therefore, never let anyone tell you that the two halves of the Bible are inconsistent, that to accept one you must reject the other. No, the Bible is all.